This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration, collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So Michael Messinger and I had the opportunity to chat about a great deal of things, mostly about international development, about compassion fatigue, about why he is doing what he does. He is now the new president of World Vision Canada. He's been in the job for several months, I think, and we get into it really quickly. So I hope you're going to enjoy this. We talk about innovation. We're talking about entrepreneurship, and we're talking about, you know, how do you remain inspired in such a cynical age? And we talk about investing in young women and about education and about what's going to make all the difference for the global South and frankly, in turn for the global North as well. So I hope you enjoy this and listen in. And again, I'm hoping to do a part two with Michael. I know I say that about every interview pretty much that I do, and that is a real pleasure for me, that there never seems to be quite enough time, and Michael and I really just started to get beyond scratching the surface. So I trust there will be a part two. Check it out, World Vision Canada, and Michael Messinger. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We've got another amazing guest with us here today, the new president of World Vision Canada, Michael Messinger, joining us today, I think from Ottawa. Michael, thanks for taking the call.
David, my pleasure. Happy to join you.
It's always, I think, really interesting for me working in the field of social justice or international development or social change to be able to talk to a leader. And you're a leader of a pretty big organization, and you know, a lot of employees doing a lot of work around the world. Worldvision.ca. If those of you out there don't know who we're talking about, check them out while we're having a conversation with the new president of World Vision Canada. So, Michael, how long have you been in the new position, and what do you see in right out of the gate?
You know, I have been in the position officially since June the 1st of this year. So I think I'm on day 87 or 88. not that I'm counting.
That's right. Yeah, you got a whiteboard at the house, right? You got a whiteboard at the house with all the little lines on it.
That's right. Although it's been a 25-year journey and of connection with World Vision. I started with World Vision actually right out of university as an intern back in 1990.
Wow.
And my path went to Geneva, Switzerland with World Vision and back to Canada. I left for law school, practiced law for a while, was on the Canadian board, came back in 2007, and then fast forward to June 1st of 2015, and I got to step into this
new amazing
role.
So when you came on as an intern, was that like an unpaid position? Like, were you like kind of like the bottom rung of the ladder at that point?
Well, I was definitely bottom rung of the ladder, but it wasn't in fact a paid internship position. It was interesting. I came out of university where I studied economics, wanting to make a difference in the world, basically. And I'd had some international experience and a couple of some internships during university, which were in fact unpaid, and wanted to use my skills and connected with World Vision, and they were interested in seeing how can we build a program for students like me who maybe had some innate leadership skills or some interesting experience, but not a lot of on the ground experience. So I spent the first 18 months at World Vision working in every single department.
I answered phones, amazing.
I did donor mails, but I also visited the field, did some work with church engagement. So it was a wonderful introduction to an organization that, of course, is part of my life, and it's a mission that I resonate with deeply.
It's a question of, I'm an electrician, so I still hold my IBEW union card, non-working. I pay my non-working dues annually. I did a 5-year, 8,500-hour apprenticeship. You must believe as a leader, I mean, having spent 18 months entering phones, cleaning washrooms, et cetera, you must believe in this idea of mentoring and sort of the passing off of the torch, if you will.
Well, you know, I believe in it because that is what set me on my career path. Hmm. I can think about, even before World Vision, significant people who came alongside me, took an interest in me, and provided me with an opportunity that was probably bigger than what I could possibly do, but encouraged me and supported me along the way. And that's why when I have an opportunity to mentor folks, and I've done that formally and informally, boy, it's incredibly rewarding, and it's something that World Vision we take really seriously, whether it's official mentoring or just leadership development for our staff, recognizing that we've got to learn and grow, and nothing compares to that one-on-one engagement with somebody that you respect and can help shape your life. And I know it because that's what happened to me.
Do you ever remember a time when somebody came alongside you and said, you know what, Michael, you're destined for greatness. You're going to lead this organization one day. You've got, you know, qualities, X, Y, and Z kind of qualities that others don't seem to have. Did you have that, a presence like that in your life, or did you get that from a variety of places?
Well, it's really interesting. I don't think anyone actually ever said that to me, for which I'm grateful.
Huh.
Because I think the last thing I need in this kind of job is to have an outsized sense of you know, my own ability. People
right.
have affirmed me along the way. What's really fascinating, though, David, is the person who hired me at World Vision in I think the fall of 1989, Linda Tripp. She was a longtime World Vision staff person.
I know the name.
Yeah, well, she recently spoke at the commissioning service that we had from World Vision, reflecting back on that. And she said, from the moment she met me, she saw me as a future leader for World Vision. So I think it's one of those things where, even though perhaps they weren't telling me that to my face, even though I was getting good reviews along the way, I had people who believed in me and helped make it possible for me to be all that God had created me to be.
Right.
You know, to look for the gifts, identify those, find places to plug in and make a difference, and obviously found, really recognized in me, I suppose, somebody who not only had those skills kind of in the air, but was deeply committed to and focused on the mission we have as an organization for the well-being of children around the world.
So, a couple questions. I didn't know it was 25 years. It's remarkable for a variety of reasons. But I guess I want to ask you a couple questions that are sort of linked. Feel free to answer them sort of all at the same time if you like. But Lester Pearson in the 60s was commissioned by Robert McNamara to write a report called Partners in Development. And it's quite, I don't know if you've seen it. It's available at your local library, probably not read very often. And it's really detailed. And if you were to read something from this today, I could quote something right now. It's on my shelf here somewhere. And you'd say to me, wow, that sounds like an article I read in the Globe and Mail yesterday. And, you know, it's like over 50 years. And so I guess my point is development workers today, in some ways, are discovering things that happened 50 years ago and that were really not that much of a surprise to Lester Pearson and the group that he was with. In your 25 years, I mean, have things changed that much? Are people less generous today? Are they more generous? Have things, you know, do we live in a worse world than we used to? Are there more natural disasters? You know, I'm asking a pretty big question, I guess, Michael, but it's related to everything, really. I guess because I want to talk to you a little bit about entrepreneurship and innovation as well. But anyway, big question.
Well, yeah, I think that there are always people who write at certain points, and Pearson is probably a good example. We can think of some others that who were, you know, were prophetic in a sense in their
yes.
time.
So yeah,
they
yeah.
were speaking about, they were describing a reality in front of them, but they saw implications for things down the line that maybe wouldn't enter into the mainstream way of working for some time. I mean, if I even reflect back on the way World Vision has done its relief and development work, we started as an organization founded by a missionary who was challenged to help one child and had to do it from back at home in the United States.
Yeah.
That was where the child sponsorship model
pretty amazing, really.
Yeah, really. And it was in the context of an evangelistic campaign, and you know, there was not a lot of concept there around social justice as we think about it from a faith perspective. It's just sort of nascent ideas.
Sure, yep.
And we think of the transfer of what that looks like. We've taken the core. What stayed the same is that focus on individual children as a reflection of the future of their communities and investing in kids. But it's gone from a handout kind of approach. So it started actually institutional approach to a community-based approach that was much more handout to where we are today, which is trying to build sustainable long-term partnerships with communities, recognizing that families in communities, even children themselves are, this is a bit of lingo, but, you know, the agents of their own development. Mm-hmm. If we can't help equip them to be the entrepreneurs of the future, to contribute in a significant way economically, then we're once World Vision or other organizations leave, then things just, you know, they tend to revert back to the way they were before. So that's something that we have changed over the years and recognized. And I know that there have been people pushing us before our practice follows up with some of those ideas. But I would say this, David, in response to your question, what we can say is that while the kinds of things we grapple with in the world, children facing poverty and injustice, wars, conflicts, significant changes, these things, they're all present. The way they're manifesting themselves right now, I would say, even based on my 25 years, are coming out in some ways that are deeply, deeply worrying. But also there are some things afoot within this sector that I think are actually quite encouraging.
Oh, good.
So on the worrying side, as we think about the emergence of the vulnerability of children, for example, in what are called fragile states. These are countries that kind of just barely hang on by their fingertips, if you'll forgive the metaphor, where institutions don't work the way we think they are. Perhaps corruption is significant, or they're at risk of conflict, or they're just at the beginning of building institutions, and they're not quite there yet. It's in those places where you don't have that stable basis. It's very, very difficult to do long-term partnerships that will have impact going forward. And we see pockets of that all over the place. And we even see fragile contexts within a more fragile, in a more stable context.
Sure.
So there are places, for example, in Kenya right now that are subject to instability. And Kenya, in the developing world, is actually pretty stable, all things considered.
Right, right.
But there are places where those elements of fragility are kicking in, and all of a sudden, anybody who's vulnerable in that society is more vulnerable because the means of support disappear, or it gets more difficult to be good stewards of resources and ensure that funds or resources reach those in need. So we're seeing the rise of that, both because of just the instabilities in the world at the moment and particular conflicts. The conflicts that we are seeing feel more intractable than ever before, and we're less able to get our heads and arms around it. I would suspect, for example, that if Pearson were around today, he might look at some of the conflicts that we're dealing with, whether it's around ISIS or Boko Haram or some of these cross-border terrorist or insurgency groups, that they really don't fit the classical ideas of warfare today, right? There's no belligerent on one side. It's very difficult. It's difficult to think of a policy response. And, of course, from our perspective, it's really difficult as well to say, how can we insert ourselves into those contexts in ways that build up for the long term and partner, but they kind of grapple with the complexities.
Well,
things are changing and they feel more complex.
It's such an understatement to say that extreme poverty and all its lines of connection is such a complicated, nuanced issue. Such an understatement, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Of course it is. And I guess when I'm confronted with the idea of extreme poverty, people ask me sometimes, is that something, can we ever eliminate it? And I don't know the answer to that, honestly, but I can tell you where I get my energy is about the sense that I am at the core of my being, from my faith, from just who I am, my values, I am called to try to eradicate extreme poverty, right? I mean, extreme poverty is the result of more than just economic deprivation or lack of resources. It's about injustice. It's about broken relationships. It's about the way we engage together. I'd say, using from my Christian faith perspective, it's about sin, the way that we are just not living the world that God has created for us. And so in the midst of that, we want to be able to say there's something bigger here. The opposite of extreme poverty is actually what we would hold out to say God's vision for right relationships in the future. You know, we've talked about his kingdom. And live out of those values rather than the values we see in extreme poverty. And that's where we're called to, and I think that's where we can begin to get our heads around how we might engage that. I don't know what the future holds, the fact is I feel like I'm placed here right now, and I need to build on a future that I believe is out there, and try to help build an organization and equip our team and the communities that we're partnering with to think about that, imagine something better.
Michael, do you think we're all called to try?
I do believe we're all called to try. I think there's an element to it.
It's a great title for a book, by the way.
Yeah, that's I'm going to make a note of that. I should say as an aside, people always say, so when are you going to write your first book?
Yeah.
Now the president of World Vision. I said, you know what? I think I'd better get my head around trying to run the place first before I start imparting wisdom to others.
Fair response.
Yeah, I do think we are all called to try. I think something uniquely human about wanting to be care and be generous to others. I think there's something uniquely Canadian about the values that we hold, even in a multicultural perspective. But I also think that particularly as Christians, we are called, you know, Jesus reduced all of the law and the prophets down to two ideas,
right?
The idea of loving God and loving our neighbor. And loving our neighbor, I believe, is trying to work on figure out those right relationships to the point that we can affect change in the lives of other people, particularly those in need. Same way that God himself valued the poor. We should be called there. And, you know, Jesus later on in the Gospels, after he talked about loving God and loving neighbor, and you see Paul as well, they really double down on the loving the neighbor part.
Right.
Really as the mark of his followers. So just, you know, as people, as we care for others, as Canadians, as we think about the values that make our country so significant, you know, so positive, a place that people want to come to, despite its faults, and particularly as Christians, I think we need to recognize that it is something that we're called to. That's where I get my sense of calling from, all three of those places.
Right.
But I don't think it's just something unique to me, David.
As I teach at Humber College, course in international development. I've been teaching there for about 5-6 years, and you know, you're in the field, you hang out, you get on the ground, and so on, and you start to say, you know, you get angry. You know, you see a situation where you need 22, like I'm working on a project where we need about $20,000 for UXO clearance in northeastern Cambodia, and it's ground the project to a halt, and you know, some RPGs and ammunition and some unexploded mines and so on. And so you get angry about that and you go, for the love, $20,000. I mean, it's nothing. And so I find I struggle with sometimes this hopeful idealism and this deep rooted sort of cynicism, almost anger in a sense, that holy cow, how do I get people to care more? I think that's why I asked you the question about being called to try. So we're called to love our neighbors, you know, second greatest commandment. I guess I want to connect the question to sort of a donor fatigue or a compassion fatigue maybe that people are feeling in the West, you know, oh geez, not another one of those images of poor children again, you know? And I love what you said about poverty, by the way. It's about broken relationships. It's about injustice. This isn't just about money. So again, huge question, Michael, and I apologize on one level, but I think, you know, Are Canadians giving enough? Are we involved? What can we do to up the ante a little bit? Can we, you know, are we turning a blind eye?
Well, one of the things I think we have to recognize is that these are huge questions. And huge questions and complex questions can't always just get a simple response.
Yeah, of course.
Sometimes compassion fatigue, you know, we hear that idea, or donor fatigue, kicks in because organizations like mine put out a simple idea that says this will change the world if we do this one thing. And in fact, the world is more complicated than that, right? The other thing I think would say is it is easy to be confronted with poverty and injustice in a way that can make you cynical. I don't think that's where we're called from. And from my perspective, even though I've seen really difficult things, I continue to remain hopeful. You don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about this. You know, my starting point in dealing with tough stuff that I see when I travel around the world is to say, I feel terrible about this. This makes me cry. This makes me sad. This makes me angry. This makes me frustrated. But in the middle of that, where I've seen that God shows up with this powerful idea of hope. A couple of places come to mind. I was in Nepal immediately after the humanitarian, the earthquake, and I was with World Vision in its humanitarian response. Immediately, I was there just about 24 hours after the earthquake.
Wow, okay.
Terrible devastation.
I guess, yeah.
And we heard story after story of heartache and loss. But even in the midst of some of the very worst stories, there were these stories, sparks of hope and heroism. In particular, I was in a remote village, and we basically turned the corner, and there was devastation. Something like 40 of the 42 houses in that village had collapsed.
Wow, crazy. Just
all we saw were piles of bricks. I spoke to a man whose daughter-in-law, a young mom, eight months pregnant, actually, died when her house collapsed around her. Of course, her unborn baby as well. Terrible disaster, you know, in a heartbeat, destroying a marriage, destroying a family. But the story was that she actually gave her life for the five-year-old daughter that she sheltered with her own body.
Wow.
As the house collapsed around her, and that little girl is living. So, and you know, being reunited with her father. Now, that's a terrible tragedy, and I can only imagine the grief and heartache. But there's an example of heroism, example of somebody giving something sacrificially, and that inspires me rather than turns me cynical. I was in northern Uganda a few years ago, sitting around a circle with soldiers who had been kidnapped from their families, these boys, when they were just young boys, and were forced to become child soldiers with the Lord's Resistance Army.
Hmm.
Unspeakable examples of things that they were forced to do. But here they were sitting around saying, we want to reengage with our community. We know what we did was wrong. We want to find reconciliation and hope. And I see the way that the community members and family members were responding. There's something in the middle of that that tells me God's at work in this. And so when we talk about this with Canadians and trying to get outside of the idea of donor fatigue, it's about trying to tell those stories.
Yeah.
Trying to say that it's not just about a magic, you know, a lever that we pull. If we just give enough loonies down a tube or something, that poverty will be gone. It's way more complicated than that. It's about relationship. It's about partnership. And I believe that we can connect with Canadians in that way, that by sharing that. I think Canadians are smart enough to get that. And because what I've seen is that when we do connect with them in that way, telling these stories, first of all, anchoring in a reality,
yep,
but also talking about what's possible and the hope in the midst of despair, people respond. It's a compelling vision. And our challenge at World Vision is to try to be as creative as we can, as innovative as we can, in getting those ideas and those stories out there.
Yeah, no,
that was a long response.
No, it's great. It's really good. I really wanted you to sort of roll there. I mean, so one of my issues is I have a tendency to sort of cut off and say, hey, can you clarify that point? And that's the burden of having read way too much philosophy in my life. Yeah, this whole idea of telling stories. I mean, I think the burden of responsibility is on World Vision in that sense. You know, you guys have the capacity and you have the ability to sort of tell a new story and a fresh story in a way, I think, that frankly can attend to some of these aspects of donor fatigue and compassion fatigue. But I love your notion about hope and inspiration versus cynicism, I guess you could say. You know, in line of this notion of complexity and you know, nuanced approaches and so on, do you think, you know, Stephen Lewis has said in Race Against Time, and I think I certainly would agree and others do too, but do you think gender, justice, and education, do you think those are the two? Are they kind of the silver bullets to sorting this all out, if you will?
Well, I don't know if I'd say they're necessarily silver bullets, but I certainly think that when we look at the causes of poverty, we have to look at the political and economic situations of the countries we're working from our grassroots experience and from the results that we see, not just from our organization, but from others. If you address education, you address the future of a community. And particularly if you can help work on gender equality or diversity and encourage, you know, if you invest in girls going to school, that's a very powerful mm-hmm. combination. And that's something that's been significant for us. I just came back about a month ago from India. I was traveling with some of our board of directors who were seeing our work firsthand, and we were up in Rajasthan in a fairly rural community, fairly conservative in terms of their views of women and gender issues, an agrarian, you know, rural context. What was so remarkable to me were meeting these savings groups that World Vision had focused mm-hmm. on, in the midst of all the other things that they could do. They worked on these self-help savings groups with women who were basically able to contribute just a handful of rupees every month working together. And we met one group that in just 5 years had set aside a significant amount. They were now talking like empowered people who had control over their destiny, that they were not just focused on what others were telling them to do, but there was a confidence there that was remarkable for any of the places that I've met. And then we also visited children's clubs, mostly with women, with girls, who were drawing these amazing pictures of, in a very careful way, about what's our community look like now, what did it look like before, and most importantly, what do we dream of in the future? And you know what they drew on every single one of the posters that they showed us? There was a picture of a boy and a girl holding hands, and they're, you know, the mother holding both the girl's hand and the boy's hand. This idea that in that community where there has been in the past this idea that, that boys or men
right.
are valued more highly, their vision is that gender equality is going to be one of the key key areas for them. And that wasn't just something that we said at the Sustainable Development Goals right. of the United Nations.
Right.
No, that's one there.
Yeah, that's not...
That in the community, at the grassroots level where World Vision is working.
It's top down and bottom up. I mean, this exactly. isn't just an academic theory. This is actually making contact with reality on the ground.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we got to wrap it up shortly, Michael, and I really apologize for that because I think I could spend the rest of the afternoon chatting with you about a variety of things, but I'm sure you have other things to do. You wrote a letter, somebody wrote a letter, I think you. I recently saw it, it was a World Vision piece about a boy you met, and I think it was in Nepal, and you told, Bitu, is that the name?
Yeah, in India, actually.
Why don't we wrap up our conversation today? Michael Messenger, by the way, with us today from World Vision, president of World Vision, all of, what was it, 87 days?
Maybe 88 by the time.
88 days, that's right. But yeah, why don't you tell us about that? And if you wouldn't mind just, and maybe I'm answering my own question here, but I also wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, we talked a tiny bit about cynicism and so on. And how do you recharge? How do you stay hopeful? How is it, you know, is it going to church on Sundays? Is it your wife? Is it your family? You know, because I think that's really important for all of us to keep in mind, you know, that there is some good news here. And I think this story of Bitu is awesome.
Well, and let me just say before that, the answer is yes to all of those.
Yeah.
I think the only way that we as humans, none of us are superhuman that I've ever met before, and I'm certainly not. You know, like, you get used to seeing some tough things sometimes, but it never gets easy. And I respond emotionally to hurt and concern and pain, and it's something you have to share with others. I build a network of friends and advisors who will listen to me in my good times and bad. Certainly my family, my wife, and my kids are critical. I have to take time out and invest in them. Finding a community that, you know, and recognize that there's something bigger than ourselves. I personally just look to God and Jesus' example to say, that's what it looks like, and I believe in that. So if I do believe that that's what the future holds, then that brings me hope and it brings me comfort, even when I can be open to God to say, I don't understand how this possibly can happen. But... you know, that probably is a good segue to the interaction that I had with a little boy, not so little now, he's about 15, named Bitu. He lives in the slums of New Delhi, the informal settlements. His family used to be rag pickers, so they were basically beggars. Now they'd moved up a little bit, and his father now sold girls' hair items in the market. But we actually tried to get to Bitu twice, because the first day it was in the middle of the monsoon rains, and unfortunately all of the sewers overflow. So in the area where he lives, which is kind of like a labyrinth of makeshift housing, when you look around, it's pieces of cardboard and corrugated iron and sticks, and I mean, it's hard to imagine that people would... It's a little bit like walking into somebody who's taken a garbage dump and kind of fashioned it into a series of dwellings that just go on and on and on. We couldn't get there the first day because the sewers, which are not covered, were backing up. So we did, though, have a chance to go and meet him. And Bitu is just a boy that I just think speaks to the kind of the things that we've been talking about today. In the midst of despair, from our perspective, you see hope. So Bitu got connected with World Vision's Child Restoration Project, which is funded by Canadians. It's not a child sponsorship program. It's not even community development. It's a bit more focused, teaching life skills, valuing education, providing tutoring to kids, helping to work on gender issues. Bittu connected with them both for a chance to support his schooling, and also through activities and social activities, keeping him out of some of the downside of that kind of environment, which are getting caught into the drug world and
right.
and some of those negative pieces. And he's now an award-winning cricketer in his little community.
Well, that's awesome.
And so here's a kid who's going, you know, his dad is able now to help support his family, at least on a basic level, and his sister goes to school as well. But he talks very fondly about the future. Now, he's got a goal right now. He wants to be a professional cricket player, which, boy, you want to support as best you can. But he knows that that's probably a long shot. And he's now connected in his schooling and is carrying on. And what's more, and I think this is what really touches me in situations like this, is that he also volunteers in the program that he was part of for so long. So he sits down as a mentor to some of the younger children
right.
and
yes.
modeling for them what does it mean to follow up on schooling, to make that a priority even in the midst of a really difficult, challenging living situation. And so it was just a privilege for me to spend time with him and his family for a long time. This is not just a face on a screen. It's not just something you read about, but this is a living, breathing human being, boy with every bit of potential as my son does, has almost the same age.
I've heard, you know, the face-to-face, the human contact, by the hand, you're in the, I think in the article that you wrote, you talked about the water up to your knees, maybe. I mean, it was deep. I mean, you can't put a price tag on that kind of tangibility, really.
That's right.
And you kind of, at some level, Michael, must say, as the president, how do we get every one of our donors over here to see this, right?
Because I wish I could do that, David. That would be because I know it would not only, it would help the bottom line of our organization because people would be committed to the work that we do, but they would be changed.
Yeah, of course.
So
yeah.
One of our challenges for us is we think about what's next. And innovation in our organization is how can I, we call it reducing the proximity gap. That is, I'm asking you to help support a child like Bittu who is on the other side of the world in some of the most challenging contexts you can be. You can't go, it's pretty difficult for you just to go around the corner and meet Bittu and see him. It's not like you give to a local hospital, which is really important. You can give to an x-ray machine. Well, you can go and see the x-ray machine and touch it if you want to. You might even get a test done there, right? So there's this idea of there's a lot of proximity. But there's a gap to these stories around the world. But we believe that some of the technology that we have, whether it's social media or just the use of the internet or new tools of video and other things, can help us begin to tell those stories better. So that children like Bittu can give us a clearer sense of what his or her community is actually like. We can begin to build those relationships and partnerships. So it's not just something that happens over there and that the money just disappears and we hope for the best and maybe you get a letter once a year. But it's a more dynamic, engaged connection because I think that we want to get to the limited extent that we can to try to find those points of connection so that the Canadians can feel what it's like to walk for a few minutes in the waterlogged shoes of
Vietnam. I've experienced that with donors, with others, and like you say, it's how can it not change you on some level, right? It's I've also heard, Michael, there's some pretty interesting things potentially happening with sort of a virtual reality 3D like nature of fundraising, how you can, you know, put on these goggles. Now you're going to get to see digitally, of course, what things are really like on the ground, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. It kind of scares me on one level, actually.
Yeah, and you know, in the midst of all of these things, any innovation like that, you want to look at it and say, is this, first of all, it may be too soon.
Right,
because some things can just be a bit gimmicky, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly
the last thing we want to do is reduce something significant like poverty to just a form of entertainment somehow.
And
not to mention the fact that innovations like this cost a lot of money. Some things are easier, of course, but we want to be good stewards of the resources that we have. So we're trying to say, how can we do this in an effective way and in a way that also doesn't put undue burden on our staff who are working with people like BT.
Right.
If they're just about trying to feed the media pipeline for donors back in Canada, that may not be the best use of their time either.
Yeah.
So these are all the challenges, but both opportunities, I guess, of some of the new technologies.
Michael, thanks so much for your time today. I like I said, always cut too short these interviews. I really appreciate your thoughts and your insight, your positive energy. It's amazing. I hope day 88 is good for you. And I look forward, I do really do look forward to chatting to you again.
I look forward to that as well, David. And you know what, I invite people, you know, your listeners to check out World Vision. If they haven't seen it for a while, go to worldvision.ca. Just take a look at some of the things that we're doing. And you know, watch this space, I guess. There's lots of new ideas out there. And if they've got ideas for us, we'd love to hear them too.
That's excellent. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.